everyone. This is Chase Oliver. He is the Libertarian Party nominee for president of these United States. He is running along with his VP nominee, Mike Termott, whom we had on last week, and he was able to give us a lot of insights into the campaign. Chase, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate the time. So let's pick up sort of the conversation that we were just having. We were discussing ballot access, and now the fact that RFK has decided to, I don't know if he's officially suspended his campaign, but functionally he suspended his campaign to endorse Donald Trump. And now you have this sort of legal tug of war in several states where RFK wants to remove his name from the ballot that he fought hard in many cases to get on. And in those states, they're forcing him to stay on. Now, I understand that in some of those states, Chase, it's just law. If you haven't removed your name by a certain filing date, you're committed to staying on the ballot. But speaking generally, do you feel it's fair play to keep RFK on certain state ballots if he does not want to be on that state ballot?
You know, I think he should be taken off any state ballot he wants to be taken off of. And I think the biggest lesson here is that if you're in a state where RFK is still on the ballot, he's not seriously running for president. He doesn't seriously want your vote for president. And he wants you to vote for Donald Trump. That's what he said. I mean, I guess in only certain states, but not in others. That doesn't make any sense to me. Really, if you want a true alternative to the two-party system, you want to go with the libertarians. We're not going anywhere. I'm not endorsing anybody. You know, I face immense pressure when I ran, when I caused the runoff in the Senate race to endorse either Herschel Walker or Raphael Warnock. When right. I say that I had very powerful members of the U.S. Senate calling me, begging me to endorse Herschel. And when I say I had, you know, prominent Democrats in the state of Georgia basically promising that I could run for the state Senate and they'd help me win so long as I endorsed Warnock. I didn't take the bait for either of those, and I won't be doing that here. But yeah, he should be able to take his name off of any ballot he wants to. Unfortunately, in many cases, ballots are already being printed. Mail-in ballots have already been produced. And we have early voting starting in just a little bit. And the first states start voting in just a couple weeks.
Right, right. So there is, there. And we had mentioned that there are some just mechanical issues, so to speak, that the ballots being printed being the primary one and filing dates needing to be observed. But Chase, even though I want to sort of, there'll be a lot of context to my question, so feel free to answer in long form if you'd like. When RFK was seeking favor with the Libertarians, with the Libertarian Party, there were a lot of people like myself who commented that, you know, it's a bad idea to say X blank is a Libertarian because he aligns with us on one issue. Or he aligns with us on one or two issues, and that the rest of his positioning is either leftist, democratic, liberal, however you want to describe it. Having said that, now, how do you feel about what does it say about RFK's positioning and Trump's that these two are able to say, hey, we've both said horrible things about each other as recently as a month or two ago, and now everything's good. It's all good now. How do you view that? Is that a net positive or a net negative for people who are saying we need to open up ballot access? We need to get ballot access. Like, you don't have ballot. People may not know this. Chase does not have ballot access in New York State, one of the bigger states in this country. And Chase, I believe you're on 48 state ballots. Is that correct?
Yeah. So there's 48. And of course, New York has some of the worst ballot access laws in the country. The number of independent candidates kind of drew up the cost of signature gathering for professional petitioners. And of course, the petitioning period was right in the middle of our nominating contest. So kind of the eyes and focus of libertarians were really more on the national convention and not getting up to New York to help get those signatures. But we hope to have an impact in this race and be able to build the foundation Libertarian Party up so that we do get ballot access going forward. And of course, we're a certified write-in candidate. You can vote for me. You just have to be able to spell my name. It will get counted. And Chase Oliver is a pretty easy name to spell. And so
yes, it is.
I do look forward to those in New York being able to vote for me. We went through the process of doing that. And so voters across the country in Illinois and in D.C. as well are able to have me as a write-in candidate. Everywhere else, we will be printed on your ballot. We'll be the third-party candidate with the most ballot access. We certainly didn't have the most funds to do that. You know, RFK had millions and millions of dollars and couldn't get on the ballot in all these states. And that just speaks to kind of maybe a lack of focus on getting on the ballot first. you know, putting the cart before the horse. And I think that's one of the reasons why he got out anyways. He knew he wasn't going to have as much ballot access as he had claimed he was going to. And so instead of failing on that promise, he then changed direction and frankly endorsed the one who gave him the opportunity first. He tried to meet Kamala Harris. We all know that. That was publicly reported a couple of weeks ago. He would have probably made the same offer to her. It speaks of opportunism from Kennedy, frankly. And I'm sorry, like, I spoke to voters this week who have felt absolutely betrayed by him dropping out of this race, particularly in Ohio. I met several voters who just said, hey, we thought Kennedy was the guy who was going to help tear down the two-party system, not join half of it. And so for me, I understand the frustration those voters have, and maybe they don't agree with me on 100% of policy. Maybe they're not 100% libertarians, but they could know good and well that voting for me is a thumb in the eye of the two-party system, and if they want to declare themselves independent of it, I'm on the ballot all over the country, and I welcome their vote. I welcome them to come in the tent and be part of this coalition that can help challenge the two-party system and grow the Libertarian Party.
Right, and I think that's the important thing that, you know, people might say, aren't you being hypocritical? You're saying if you're not as really that much of a libertarian, but you want to sort of stick it to the man and you want to sort of register a protest vote, you're saying, hey, join the libertarians. You can vote for me. I'm not going anywhere. I have integrity. I'm not going to sell out. How does that differ than, say, RFK saying, hey, I'm joining Trump. You know, what's the difference? Well, the difference is, by joining Trump, he's endorsing the duopoly. And as you said, his first move was to go back home to the Democrats and say, let's cut a deal with Kamala Harris. And again, why she didn't do it, I think strategically, is a different story. She should have probably just accepted him for whatever publicity that was worth. But I also think it speaks to the lack of integrity of the of Trump in this particular case. But for accepting RFK after spending all that time essentially calling him a crackpot. So, okay. But Chase, I want to also talk about you and your campaign. A lot of people may not realize this, but you have put in the legwork. You were in New York a week and a half ago. I was lucky enough to meet you in Manhattan for a drink to say hello. I was very happy to do that. But people don't realize, man, you're like Bruce Banner in the old Incredible Hulk series. You're just traveling from state to state, doing good, spreading a good message. For folks that don't know, Chase doesn't engage in ad hominem attacks. He doesn't like run down individuals. He runs down policies. He'll tell you what's wrong with a policy, and he'll tell you how he's going to provide a libertarian solution. So let's start out with something simple, Chase. When you look at something like Kamala Harris coming up and saying, hey, the best way to help people is I'm going to provide down payments for mortgages. I am going to tax unrealized gains. But hey, only if you own $100 million or more. I swear it won't trickle down to anybody else. We plan on forgiving student loan debt. We plan on increasing housing units in this country, all via government. For the people out there who are tempted to say Harris is right, she cares, she wants to help people, can you explain to people if that's the correct approach? And if not, how would Chase Oliver address those issues?
Well, you know, I obviously don't think it's the correct approach. I wouldn't be running against Kamala Harris and Donald Trump if I didn't both think they had bad approaches to many things. But let's just look at that piece by piece. First off, on a whole, all of what you just described is going to cost trillions and trillions of dollars in either lost revenue or unproduced gains in terms of, like, if you take money out of these gains, you're not allowing people to actually invest, you know, unrealized gains, ridiculous. But all of this will cost trillions and trillions of dollars. We'll add trillions and trillions of dollars to the debt deficit that devalues your money right now, the highest driver of inflation. So in an attempt to solve the problems, she's actually going to make several more. It's like a hydra. You cut one head off and three grow in its place, you know. And so the way, first off, you know, if you want to get costs under control, get the budget under control, stop printing trillions of dollars, stop devaluing our currency. If you want to increase the number of houses, that's not really something we want to do at the federal level. First off, paying for mortgages or putting the upfront for mortgages, that just sounds like supercharging what caused the 2008-2009 collapse. And I remember exactly what that was like because I was just getting started in the economy and I felt that uncertainty. And many people in my generation still haven't bought a home. We're still behind Gen X and boomers in terms of home ownership as millennials because of that. Okay, so we don't want to be doing that. That will make things infinitely worse. Does not spark joy. The next thing is, how do we build housing? That's a local issue. We need to get rid of all the regulation and red tape around housing, especially around multi-unit housing that these NIMBYs and cities all across America do. And why do they do it? They say it'll affect their property values. But I pose the question, what is worse, having some low-income housing in your neighborhood or having a whole bunch of homeless people on the streets in your city? I argue that one is way more effective against your property values than the other. One's way better for society. And so why don't we let the free market actually do its thing and build multi-unit housing for new families or for people who are in transit, you know, who are just getting out of school and want to have an apartment or whatever. Let's continue to do this. And last but not least, like the idea of price controls, which you didn't directly mention, that she wants to control the cost of goods via price controls. Let me just tell you right now, that is Soviet style. That is true market command economy stuff. And that is bad. That is bad for consumers. It's bad when it's, you know, it's bad when the USSR did it. It's bad when any other nation does it. And let me just tell you right now, it's like the old adage. What does dark humor and food under communism have in common? Not everybody gets it. And that's the truth. If you create price controls, you're going to create massive shortages across goods, and that's going to create misery, particularly for those lowest on the economic ladder. And so, you know, all around, her economic policies are basic leftism that are tied up in this kind of package of like, let's be joyful, let's be happy. And hey, I support people being able to live as they want to live, worship as they want to worship. I also am proud to be an American because we have that diversity of thought and diversity of life. But I don't also seek to completely overhaul our economy to something that doesn't even recognize something that the founders would have recognized. Or, you know, to me, it's just plain old leftism. And, you know, Tim Walz, America's dad, you know, America's football coach, that's what they're trying to cast him, is basically just that. That is a performative face to put on policies that I don't agree with. Hey, maybe he's a nice guy to have a beer with, but he's not a nice guy to be in control of your economic decisions or your educational decisions or anything else. That's your job to have. You should have that power. Not Tim Walz, not Kamala Harris, and frankly, not Donald Trump or J.D. Vance either with their protectionism and their other horrible economic policies.
Yeah, and that's another point I wanted to bring up. So talk to me about you kind of addressed the leftist trappings of failed economic policies, which are, of course, the Harris Walz side of the fence. But on the Trump Vance side of the fence, you know, I think their sort of leftist monetary policies are dressed up in a different way to sort of present differently. But it really the underlying thing you mentioned, protectionism, the tariffs. How tariffs are real. You know, I saw Trump and I saw Vance say this recently. Hey, the biggest victims of our tariffs will be the Chinese, will be the Mexicans, not the American people. Now that's utter trash, isn't it? Like the
complete nonsense.
Right. Explain to the people why tariffs actually hurt Americans more than the target countries of those tariffs.
So just a couple things. So the base of it is, first off, if you add a cost to something that you're importing, that business has to pay more for it to buy it. So it makes the cost of goods go up. And you may say, well, good, that'll get people to buy American, and that's great. Except it's not great because it also costs American jobs. So I worked for years in the logistics industry, the maritime logistics industry, for a firm that was responsible for moving goods from one side of the world to the other, bring them to the United States. Think about this. Okay, let's say a textile is produced in China, all right? All right, the textile produced, yeah, that comes from a Chinese worker, and it's taken to a port, gets on a ship. When it gets off that ship, it's unloaded by an American longshoreman, all right? It's then put onto a truck that's driven by an American truck driver who takes it to a rail yard that's managed by Americans. They put it on a train that's managed by Americans, run by Americans. Then they take that off of the train onto another truck that's driven by an American to a warehouse that's worked by Americans and run by Americans. And then they take it into another truck to take it to the final destination, the Walmart, where that all employs Americans. And of course, it comes off of the store shelf in your cart, where it then clothes Americans. And so every step of the line, you're actually creating jobs all across the supply chain. And these are the people that Donald Trump and others hailed as heroes during the pandemic, the truck drivers, the rail workers, those people who kept the supply chain going. Well, you know what keeps the supply chain going? Free trade. The ability to bring goods in this country at a lower cost. So that way it's lower cost to consumers. That is better all around for us. And that's the truth. And you know, we can still engage the world in trade and still have the most powerful economy while still accepting goods in across this country free. Without the cost of tariffs.
Right.
You know, to me, This costs American jobs, especially in small businesses that have the tightest margins. And those are the people that need to have relief here and relief from inflation and cost of business going up. And neither Trump nor Kamala Harris are advocating that. Frankly, I'm the only free market candidate left in this race because neither is Jill Stein or Cornel West or any of the other independents that are all left of center who are closer to Kamala Harris's command economy style. But this protectionism, nativism on the right is also toxic to our economy. It will cost us jobs and it will cost us prosperity. And so if you truly believe in the free market, there's only one choice on your ballot. And that's me. That's the libertarians. And guess what? If you don't think I can explain that well enough, talk to my VP candidate. He's an economics professor. He can explain it to you in long form if you need the footnotes.
Actually, we did ask Mike to explain it in long form last week, and he did. So I want to thank both of you for that, because you're right. I think people have lost track of what a free market really means. And it was Milton Friedman who once said that tariffs, to your point, are a tax on the United States if we're issuing. But it's also favoritism for a small political class at the expense of a large political class. Very few people in the U.S. benefit from tariffs, but they tend to be elites, big business owners or politicians, whereas the everyday consumer loses as a result of tariffs. Their costs go up. Their cost of living goes up. They lose their jobs. Chase, another thing that I think ties into both the economy and basic libertarian ideals of human rights and the ability for individuals to determine their own fate, immigration. Both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are now sparring over how quickly they can shut off immigration into this country. Trump in particular, the nativists, the protectionists, they are very openly announcing, hey, put me in office, says Trump, and I'll make sure I begin the largest mass deportation of illegal immigrants into this country. 10, 11, 12 million people. Two things. Talk to me about whether you think this is the correct move. Also talk to me the effects of the economy if Trump gets elected and that's executed, or if Harris gets elected and somehow she manages to seal all the borders and shut down immigration into the U.S.
Yeah, so I don't believe that's the right approach. First off, again, to do such a thing, such a mass deportation program, not only would it be a complete human rights abuse, like to push such a program would be getting everybody who's under a certain shade of white basically getting their papers checked. I mean, this would lead to major problems, particularly in the southwestern states of the United States. We would see major inhibitions on civil liberties. You would have to, de facto suspect everybody and presume guilt of everyone. And that is just not workable to actually truly deport every single person who's here illegally. That's complete political rhetorical hogwash, unless you want to violate the civil liberties of every single American. And so it's not workable. And so, no, that's not the solution we need to be having. Secondly, you're talking about the economic impact. First, immigrants contribute to the economic pie. They help create jobs. They help create prosperity. They help create business. They buy homes. They rent homes. They have children who then become business owners or part of the economy themselves. Like, there is a benefit to immigration. Nearly every economic study shows this. You can just look at the studies that come out of Cato regularly that examine these things, particularly in states like Texas. Right. Texas is the second most populous state in terms of illegal immigrants, second most populous state in terms of general population. Great case study. And when Rice University did a study of this, they actually showed that immigrants actually created a net positive to the tax revenue of over $420 million in a year, in a single fiscal year, in Texas alone. And so the economic impact is actually positive when we allow immigrants to come here and work. And the ease of immigration is what we need to be seeing. An actual streamlined process, not sealing off the border, that will create another human rights abuse. And people, by the way, you build a 20-foot tall wall, you'll see 20-foot tall ladders at the southern border. People will climb over that wall. They'll dig underneath it. They'll find a way around it. And so there's just, and never mind the fact that most people who are here without documentation do so by just overstaying a visa. They came here on an airplane. They didn't come here by crossing the southern border. And so to really address the issue, we need to streamline the process of giving people proper documentation to work, allow these people in these communities to come out of the shadows so no longer they're being exploited for their labor or being exploited by the criminal justice system that, they're too scared to go report a crime out of fear of deportation. This would make our community safer. It would bring wages back up for workers who aren't having to compete against wages being artificially driven down due to lack of documentation. This would be better for our economy. But sadly, again, due to nativism and protectionism, and then, of course, Kamala Harris not wanting to appear soft on immigration, just like Democrats in the past didn't want to appear soft on crime. Well, guess what that gave us? The 94 crime bill. It gave us the worst kind of criminal justice reform we could have ever had. And so I pray that voters wake up and realize this is just a sham on Kamala Harris's part to try to talk tough. And on Donald Trump's part, it's unconscionable. It's something he's been wanting for 12 years. And it's the worst kind of nativism that will prevent us from having a lot of wonderful people in this country if it was implemented. And a lot of our civil rights would be violated in the process. And I think that's just a terrible scenario. And I wouldn't want to see it.
Would a President Oliver offer amnesty to those illegal aliens currently in the U.S.?
I would say if you're here in the United States, you should pass the same test that I want you to pass if you were to come through the southern border, a background check, a criminal background check, and a health check. If you can pass both those things, you should be able to stay here with some sort of legal documentation. We would set some sort of set period for anybody who's already here to do that. If they haven't done it by then, at that point, you would be considered somebody who is, basically hit away from documentation. You're not wanting to be noticed that you're here. There's probably a reason for that when we want to examine that and then go through a legal process of either deportation or some other means. But that is how you do that. You give people a chance to come out of the shadows. And that way you can hyper-focus on those who are still wanting to hide. And that's for good reason. Many times it's for labor or sexual exploitation, other things. We can laser focus on that instead of the people who just want to be peacefully here to work and start a business and raise a family. Their American dream, just like we all had from our ancestors. 40% of Americans, 40% of Americans have family that came through Ellis Island. That's why we need a 21st century Ellis Island.
Yep. I by the way, several Ellis Islands all over the country. I agree with you on that's the best model. And that's always been the model that's worked for this country. And unfortunately, this country has always battled the anti-immigrant bias. It's been a political movement throughout our country at almost predictable intervals. You know, whether you started with the Know Nothing Party or, you know, it just seems to be unfortunately part of this country as well. Quick comment. Someone, Jay White just says, Chase Oliver, 2024 with the Statue of Liberty. Not really a question. Just wants to say he's a Chase supporter. Thank you for that, Jay. Okay, so let's move on a little bit, Chase, because I also know you have a little bit short on time today, but two major foreign policy situations, let's talk about them. Everyone's concerned about it. One is the Ukraine, and the other one is the Israel-Palestine conflict. Give me your positions on both those issues, please.
Well, you know, I think I've said for a long time that if there's going to be military aid going to Ukraine, it has to stop coming from the United States. Europe needs to actually start taking the lead there if they want to. And we need to take the lead on the humanitarian side by allowing those who are in the crossfire, namely women and children, the ability to come to the United States as refugees. And I've always had the policy against conscription. I oppose conscription here in the United States. I oppose it anywhere else. And frankly, I think if you're being conscripted into war, that is a legitimate case for amnesty. You should be able to come to the United States and claim amnesty because nobody should be forced to fight in a war they don't want to fight. And I would make that offer to anybody who's currently in the conflict, especially all of those people on the Russian front lines, because a lot of those people are conscripts. They don't want to be fighting any more than they have to.
Right.
Basically, they have guns ahead of them and guns behind them if they try to go AWOL. But if they do decide to try to fight for their freedom, the United States should be allowing them to come here with amnesty. And so that's how I feel about, you know, Ukraine. We can have a humanitarian side of things, but I'm tired of seeing the United States war machine funding wars around the world. And if Poland and Germany and France and the UK want to take the lead there, they should be allowed to do that as we extricate ourselves from that situation militarily. As far as Israel-Palestine.
I'm sorry, before you go on to Israel-Palestine, just want to follow up. When you say humanitarian aid for Ukraine, like you're opposed to military aid, you would accept conscripts as refugees amnesty. Into this country, yeah. Amnesty, accept them as refugees. When you say humanitarian aid, are you talking about sending them financial aid? Or is it a matter of sending them food? Is it a matter of medical supplies? Describe humanitarian aid for those that say, hey, we're also done with foreign aid. We don't want foreign aid to the Ukraine.
So when I say humanitarian aid, I mean two things. One, allowing the refugees to come into this country, which is its own form of humanitarian aid. And then secondly, allowing private partnerships, if they choose to do so, to support people on the ground via NGOs and nonprofits, not the government funding this. This is you funding it out of your own pocket. And frankly, I'll be frank. if you want to fund the Ukrainian military, you want to go fight over there, that's you. You can do that. We should not be doing that with U.S. taxpayers. We shouldn't be putting the U.S. military in that way either. And I know there are people who have done that. If they want to do that, that's on them. I don't think we should put anybody at risk who doesn't want to be. And I don't think we should be putting any military arms into the hands of anybody that isn't purchased, you know, through a private means, that sort of thing. I don't think the government should be funding that. But that's where humanitarian aid, any kind of aid, should be coming from. Should not be coming from Uncle Sam. It should be coming from you and me if we decide to donate in that direction. And, you know, I know there are great charities that are doing great work out there for those who are suffering in that region of the world. And I would encourage us to, you know, privately donate to there instead of being taxed out of our pockets to send more bombs and more missiles into the situation.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Okay. I'm sorry. Palestine and Israel now. How would you, what's your position on that conflict?
Well, once again, I think we need to remove ourselves from military aid in that region. You know, October 7th was a horrible thing, right? I don't think anybody can deny that. What Hamas did on October 7th was unconscionable, was disgusting to see people gunned down and murdered, you know, over 1,400 people. That was wrong. And, you know, obviously that should be like, anybody that questions that is crazy to me. But I also question the heavy-handed, frankly, destructive response on behalf of Israel, which has just completely destroyed all of Gaza's infrastructure, the, you know, the living situation for hundreds of thousands of people, have killed tens of thousands of people, have created misery for many, many people, including women and children. I think, frankly, the worst part about this entire conflict is that both populations have been completely and utterly let down. And I think the Netanyahu war machine, who we claim to be the direct ally of, we have to call them out directly. And we have to say, this is wrong, the way you're killing so many people in Gaza.
Right.
We also have to call for a release of hostages, which I always have. But I've also always called for stop airstriking the places where the hostages might be. That puts them at risk the way Israel's conducting this war. And so for me, I want to see a true disengagement and a work towards ceasefire. But sadly, both populations are going to have to demand a change in leadership to get that to happen, because Hamas, who is controlling Gaza, I don't think they're really interested in peace. The people of Palestine are going to have to toss them out and rise up and say, we want actual some way to have some semblance of life and peace. And at the same time, we certainly have to see a changeover in the leadership of the government of Israel, because I don't think Netanyahu is going to stop this war until he either eradicates all the people of Gaza or he is removed from power. And the reason being is because as soon as the war stops, the questions started getting asked. The first question being, how did you allow October 7th to happen to us? The second question being, hey, weren't you up for corruption charges? Weren't you being investigated for these things before October 7th happened? We need to resume those questions being asked. And so selfishly, I think the Netanyahu government is contributing to this war being longer than it needs to be. And the people of Israel are less safe for that. And the people of Israel have to demand a change. But again, I don't hold any ill will towards the people of Palestine or the people of Israel, who are innocent in this. You know why? Because if I condemned people for the actions of their government, I would have to condemn every single American, because our government does some pretty terrible things. And so I have to recognize the difference between people and governments. And the governments are what's letting the people down here in this case. It's creating more war, more death, more misery, and reducing the conditions for peace, not just between those two peoples, but in the entire region. So we've seen this spreading into Lebanon, tensions with Iran. It has a potential to be a major, major war if we don't start the process of peace immediately. And sadly enough, neither Donald Trump nor Kamala Harris are truly interested in that process in a way that will be lasting and binding.
Interesting. Okay. There's a question from the audience. Linda wants to know, what is Israel supposed to do when Hamas uses civilians to hide behind? That tactic has been going on since before any of us were alive. It seems as if Israel is in a no-win situation.
So first and foremost, I think anyone in Gaza is going to be hiding behind civilians, because it's one of the most densely populated areas in the world. It's very hard to have anything that's not near a civilian in Gaza, which is why the policy of airstriking is so terrible, because it creates so much collateral damage. Israel should be much more surgical in going into the country, you know, via, you know, you can do that via armored vehicle and individual soldiers root the troops out. Now, this might be more dangerous for the average IDF soldier, but had that been the process that Israel took from the very beginning, you would have much more goodwill around the world. You wouldn't have protests condemning their actions around the world. And you would actually much the Arab world saying, hey, this is the best way they can possibly conduct this. They're doing their best. But the idea of, oh, well, we drop leaflets and then we blow up entire neighborhoods, Well, yeah. I mean, imagine if you had only 1 hour to take everything you can out of where you live and then right. run for your life with you and your family. That's still not compassionate to me. And that causes far too many deaths. And someone said on C-SPAN the other day, and it really did outrage me when they said, well, this is how war goes. Don't you know, if they kill 1200 of us, you don't just kill 1200 of them. You got to kill way more than to make it hurt. You got to punish them. And I reminded them that former Congressman Justin Amash, he has family living in Palestine, Palestinian right. Christians who have nothing to do with Hamas. And yet his little cousin, who's an infant, died dead in the rubble. Did that baby deserve to be punished? No, they didn't. Their cries and their death is just as sacred and just as sad as the death of an Israeli child. We should not be cheering on for the death and misery for any population. And so what Israel should have been doing from the very beginning, and they would have had the entire goodwill of the United States and everyone else, right. they've been more surgical in their approach to root out the tunnels and to take out the leadership via ground troops, as opposed to airstrikes, which indiscriminately kill far more people.
Okay. And thank you, Linda, for that question. Okay. So some other things I wanted to touch on. We talked about economic policies, but something we didn't actually talk about, and it just speaks, I think, you said you're a millennial, I'm a Gen Xer. So, you know, your older generation talking to a younger generation right now, and hopefully we're also reaching out to Gen Y and Gen Z as well. There's a lot of what is viewed as wealth inequality in this country. There's a perception of poverty, which I would argue is not accurate. You know, the bottom 1% of the U.S. still is probably in the top 10% of the world. But how would you address questions of wealth inequality and poverty, which unfortunately leads to demands of socialism, wealth redistribution, et cetera?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that I remind people the most is, like, have you ever noticed that, you know, small businesses create the most jobs in this country? They're the economic driver and the economic engine of this country, but yet the profit margins are the tightest for them, and the biggest profit margins go to those giant firms, those huge multinationals. Why is that? Why is there that inequality? Well, it's because those giant multinationals buy and pay for your Congress via lobbying. They get every carve-out and deduction their tax attorneys can think of, so that way the cost of them doing business is far lower than your mom and pop right. shops. This is what's led to the hollowing out of our downtowns. This is what has led to the death of many small businesses across this country. And this is why so many businesses, small businesses, medium businesses, could not survive the weathering of COVID, even if they had some pittance of government assistance to help them. This is why tens of thousands disappeared and never came back, because they could not weather the storm, because their margins were so tight. My solution to this is to quit giving favors, to remove all those carve-outs, to remove all those deductions, and lower the overall cost of doing business and starting a business. What this will lead is a lot more people to jump into the entrepreneurial space. We'll have a lot more people starting a business or hiring people because they're starting those new businesses. This will allow for true more free market competition, which will spur more innovation, which will spur more efficiencies in the marketplace, lowering the cost of goods. Like, these are the true free market principles that we need to return ourselves to get some sort of competition back in the market that will lower the cost overall right. for consumers. That's you and that's me and that's anybody else when they go to the grocery store or when they go to buy any goods or a home. These are the things that we can do to truly bring the marketplace economics back, instead of trying to band-aid everything with federal programs that give out taxpayer money that then will cost us down the line for our kids and grandkids. And so we have to have somebody that's sounding the alarm about the cliff we're about to fall off of, but also say that if we change course, if we do this, yes, there's always going to be some pain. And the truth is there would have been less pain 20 years ago, and there's going to be more pain 20 years from now. And at some point, we are going to change course or we'll fall off the cliff. But we need to change course now so we can have a true brighter future that is going to lead to more income equality, more people actually being able to get themselves ahead if they work hard, start a business, or contribute to the economy. Like, that is what we want to see. Now, there's a lot of knots that need to be untied at the federal right. level and at the state level and even at the local level to allow for this competition. But we libertarians are keen on doing that. We want to untie every knot that burdens you, that burdens the marketplace, and that burdens you as a consumer from having the best price, for the best products at the best time, because that's what the hand of the marketplace will bring you. That's what the true visible hand of government prevents so often. So if I can inspire young people to think about this, what we have had now is the same thing for the last 60 years since World War II, 70 years. since World War II, 80 years now. Jesus. I know. I still feel like the 80s are 20 years ago, that kind of a thing.
Yep, same thing.
You know, but since the war ended, right, we have had the same thing over and over again. Pump up the economy, the bubble bursts. Pump up the economy, the bubble bursts into recession. And this is because we've only had Republicans and Democrats who think short term. They think about the next 2 years or the next financial quarter. We need to be thinking about the next 20 years. That's what we need, America. And that's why we have a younger person in the Libertarian Party running for president. I'm going to be alive in 40 years. Joe Biden won't. Donald Trump won't. Kamala Harris probably won't either. She's 60, so she would be 100 if she were alive in 40 years. The truth is we need to have somebody who's looking to the future, because we're going to be living in the future. And I just hope voters out there can feel inspired to check out our campaign and to see the difference. Kick the tires, as I say. Take a blind taste test and see who you like the best. And I bet you're more libertarian than you realize.
Yeah, I think, well, it's one of those weird things that when you ask people issue by issue, the answers you get on all those political tests tend to clump around libertarian the most, you know, roughly a quarter of this country, which is not in proportion to the way people vote. And I think that does have a lot to do with ballot access. It does have a lot to do with getting on debate stages with the duopoly to challenge them face to face. It is very interesting, because I do remember Milton Friedman saying this back in the day. Look, I'm sure people your age, Chase, I say this all the time, you're probably Ron Paul people. Ron Paul inspired a lot of the younger folks into libertarianism. In my day, it was Milton Friedman. It was watching Milton Friedman on the Phil Donahue show, on things like that, come out and explain things and how inflation works, which a lot of people to this day, you hear the lie repeated by Kamala Harris, by Elizabeth Warren. It's these greedy capitalists, these multinationals, it's because of their greed that we have inflation. You know, they never tell you that when inflation's running at 2%, what happened to their greed? Did they stop being greedy at that point, or is it just now that they're greedy?
Here's why that doesn't make sense. And first off, yes, of course, corporations are guided by greed. They're guided by profit motive. It's not as if they were not greedy 5 years ago or more greedy 10 years from now. They're always going to be greedy and driven by profit. But that actually drives them to be more efficient, actually keep costs in an equilibrium where consumers want to buy their things. If they could keep costs low, they would do it. It's the fact that the costs are rising for all the costs of production. And that happens because our dollar is being devalued. And so, yeah, the cost of, Lay's potato chips are going to go up. That's because the cost of producing Lay's potato chips is going up. And why is that? Because the dollar that's used to buy all of the things that go into producing that, the potatoes, the oil, the salt, the packaging, the truck drivers, well, that's because their dollars are being worth less and less and less because government keeps printing more and more and more. And it's basic economics. And you're right. I think people need to go on Amazon Prime right now and watch Free to Choose with Milton Friedman. Did you know it was on Amazon Prime last I checked. So they can check it out and learn for themselves from Milton Friedman, just like you did.
One of the great tomes. Another one I want to promote, and I'll cross promo myself. I just did a wonderful interview, a full length interview with Dr. Johan Norberg, who does a wonderful job he wrote the Capitalist Manifesto. Wonderful job of explaining the positivity of capitalism and free market economics and why Sweden is not the socialist paradise of the world that you've been led to believe that it is, that it's actually a capitalist paradise. All right, some more comments. Jay White, Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago properties have nothing but illegal immigrants working there. And I saw it firsthand back in 2014 when I rented a room there. And he follows up by saying both Republicans and Democrats want the illegal immigrants for cheap labor. Okay. I guess that's one way of looking at it. But just to wrap up the inequality and everything, I love what you just said in passing a couple of moments ago. You said the visible hand of the government. And I'm assuming you meant that in stark contrast to Adam Smith's invisible hand, which is what guides the free market and leads to the greatest amount of productivity among individuals.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm referencing. It's the very opposite of that notion. And that's exactly what governments bring us, is that invisible hand that just interjects itself anytime it wants to the detriment of consumers. And that's you, me, everybody else who buys anything at any store anywhere, that's trying to raise our families across this country, trying to educate our kids, trying to put a good roof over their head and good food in their bodies. That's being prevented exactly by that very visible hand. And we need to remove it as quickly as possible.
Get government out of the business of business. Absolutely. And, for those of you out there, I wish I had thought of this. I would have prepared a graph. But trust me, go look it up. Go Google it. the industries in this country whose inflation rate far outstrips the general inflation rate are always the ones that are most heavily regulated by government. Healthcare, housing, education, all these things where government has a very heavy hand, to Chase's point. Their inflation rate is multiples of the overall inflation rate, much higher than food, gasoline, or anything like that. When you're talking about healthcare, look at it yourselves, folks. When I went to college, I know what it cost me. When my niece goes to college 3 years ago, it's like 10 times the cost, okay? And that's over the course of 30 years. It should not be that kind of multiple. It is that way because of the government spigot, just spilling dollars into that industry, Chase. So, yeah, that you would think that people would notice that correlation, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, unfortunately, too many people don't. You know, they just see them, you know, they just... to me, too many people are just conditioned to think that either the Republicans or Democrats have the right idea and that the other people are just terrible. And they don't really throw logic into it a lot of the times. You know, I wish, you know, Donald Trump likes to talk about the late, great Hannibal Lecter, you know, as if that's a real person. You know, if I could have any fictional character come in and work in politics, it would be Spock, because he would bring logic into the situation and like actual... Okay. You know, statistics and numbers, and they would probably be the best person we could vote for. But absent voting for Spock, you can vote for me. You can vote for Mike Tremont, who's an economist, and you can rest assured that we will do the best we can to keep costs low for families across America, because we are regular working people. I wasn't born into privilege. I haven't only worked in government my entire life. I've actually had to, you know, make ends meet, work paycheck to paycheck, and actually struggle, unlike my opponents who have either worked for the government their whole lives or born with that silver spoon. And so for me, I'm just a regular Joe trying to make the world better for other regular Joes and Janes out there.
You sure are. And you know something, I do want to say something since you mentioned Spock. I just noticed while you were talking, you do have a little bit of resemblance to Zachary Quinto, just a little bit, just now.
I will take that.
Okay, fair enough. Actually, here's another question. The Gridiron Geezer Show wants to know, what would an Oliver administration do to help the world combat climate change? That's a good question.
Well, first and foremost, we're going to keep as much regulations out of the energy race as possible, because right now, the energy that we subsidize the most is carbon-based energy, oil, natural gas, and coal. Remove all subsidies from energy altogether, and of course, remove the regulatory hurdles away from nuclear power and let consumers pick which power they want to most embrace. Consumers want cleaner and dependable energy. I have a feeling that nuclear would win that race if it wasn't shackled by so much federal regulation. Right. So I think that's the best way to address how we power our homes. And then in terms of, you know, how are we going to help the world combat climate change, the best thing the United States government can do is cut down what the Department of Defense does, because they're the largest driver of pollution in the United States is the Department of Defense, is the amount of carbon we spew in the air because we're creating so many weapons and all this stuff. I say we move ourselves to a much smaller military footprint around the world as we're ending these wars and bringing our troops home. It also has the added benefit of not putting so much carbon into the air. So if you want to fight for a cleaner air and cleaner water, then fight for a world less at war, because that's one of the primary drivers of carbon pollution. So both those things I think we could do and actually lead to more innovation in the future. And I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely. Now, as a follow-up, and thanks, Gridiron Crew, for the comment. As a follow-up, two-parter, is there climate change? And if there is there a climate emergency?
Yeah, I think there's definitely, you know, you can see statistics that show the climate is changing and that we probably have some sort of impact on that due to carbon, of course. Do I think it's an emergency? No, because I believe in the power of human innovation and human conditions for survival. We are going to figure out a way to continue to survive on this planet. And, you know, I'll credit Dave Smith, who said this to me in New Jersey. We were talking about climate change, and he was mentioning how, you know, China's bringing all these coal-fired power plants online. And he said, you know, everybody hates on this, but what if the person who's going to create all the solutions to climate change is now being born in the Chinese middle class instead of being a peasant? Because of all these coal-fired power plants bringing about prosperity for that part of the world, it pulled 1 billion people out of poverty. And so yeah. I tend to believe that, you know, whatever we're working on, we're going to be working towards something better that will be the human condition to make things better for humanity. And there's always a vested interest in that. So there will always be a motive to improve. And I have faith in the human spirit that we can do something to stop this from happening. And it's not an emergency. It's an opportunity for us to develop the next technologies that will help us live longer and more prosperous. speaking of living long and prospering, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, gotcha. That, I like that tie-in, by the way, Chase. And you know, really, I don't know if people realize this or not, but part of when you accept libertarianism and individual liberty, you almost have to obtain a belief in the individual, in the power of people to rule themselves, to be able to innovate, and to really, at least from my perspective, appreciate the joy of life. You know, like to your point, yeah, Dave Smith is absolutely right about that. Like, what about the person who may have frozen to death or didn't have the opportunity to go to school or didn't have the opportunity to eat properly to stimulate their brain and have enough protein and all that? All that comes with prosperity. And those are the people of the next generation that will come up with solutions. The next Elons, the next Jeff Bezos, whoever you find, the next Watson and Crick, whoever you find inspiring, they were once young people. They had to survive. They had to be nourished along the way. So that's a great point. And I think being libertarian, do you feel that? Do you think libertarianism kind of fosters that sort of positive outlook in people?
You know, I think a lot of libertarians, sadly, they might be cynics because if they see how bad the government is, they think it'll never get better. But I'm actually a libertarian optimist that thinks we will get better. We will figure out a better way to do these things. You know, there might be tougher times before it happens, but we are going to get over the hump as a species, I think. And so I'm a glass half full libertarian. I hope a lot of people are, because frankly, I think it's the best way to sell our philosophy is not how doomed we already are, but what possibilities we could have if we embrace the concepts of liberty and change course. I tend to think that it could be brighter days ahead if we embrace those ideas, those principles, like free markets and free voluntary exchange. I think the sky's the limit and then some.
Okay. Last question I want to wrap up on, free speech and the ability to get your message out and the ability not to be censored, not to be canceled. Talk to me. What's a bigger threat to free speech in this country right now? Is it the government or is it tech, private business? What do you, or is it society itself? Are we censoring ourselves? What to you is the greater threat to free speech, Chase?
Oh, I think it's government, because I think a lot of the pressure that tech has had to censor, it comes straight from government, as we've seen with the Zuckerberg letter that just came out this week to the Congress. You know, he basically came out and said, yeah, we felt pressured. In retrospect, we wouldn't have done these things. We've changed our practices to not have it happen again. That's just a sign of the free market and the private market being able to learn from itself and adapt better than a government ever could. But much of that pressure came from government. It will continue to come from government, and we have to speak out against it. You know, there's great organizations out there that do those things. And of course, the Libertarian Party will continue to speak out for free speech here and everywhere else.
Fantastic. What do you feel about society? Are we censoring ourselves? Are we ratting each other out? Are we looking for victimization, Chase?
I mean, by and large, I think most people just want to, you know, pay attention to themselves, the people they love. There are people out there, the so-called Karens out there who constantly have to censor or police everything that's ever said or done. But I think most people aren't that way. I think those are just the loudest voices, and oftentimes it's the loudest voices that get the most attention. It's most people just living quietly, living their lives, going about their lives, that maybe doesn't get the same amount of attention, but I think that's the far greater crowd.
There you go, folks. Chase, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to put up your campaign site, votechaseoliver.com. Folks, go out there and support Chase. Chase, please let us know where you're campaigning next and how people can contribute to the Oliver Termott ticket.
Well, you can, of course, go to votechaseoliver.com. You can join the campaign as a donor supporter or as a volunteer if you want to join us in volunteer efforts. Get out the vote effort. It's going to be starting very shortly as early voting gets online. We're going to need all the people to help to do that. And, of course, your monetary donations will actually help put the fuel in that engine to have us going across the country. Next place I'm heading, actually, is informally, I'm heading Saturday to go to the UT game with my mom. But then I'm also staying in Knoxville for a few days to shoot some ad content. So we're going to have some great new ads coming out right as the voters are starting to get keyed in right after Labor Day. And so we're going to be firing on all cylinders. And of course, we're having a heavy travel schedule. Off the top of my head, I'm pretty sure I'm going back to Florida pretty soon. Texas again, I'm pretty sure I'm going back to. And I'm going to be in Indiana in September speaking to the Indiana Rainbow Chamber of Commerce. That's going to be a great event because, of course, I'm the only free market candidate they got left. And so I'm looking forward to speaking to those who are responsible for being entrepreneurs and creating businesses coming up in Indianapolis. So we got a lot of stops coming up. If you want to stay tuned to that, you can go to the event page at votechaseoliver.com and see where we're going to be and what we're doing. And not just myself, we're also sending Mike Tremont all over the country to speak that message as well. I got a great running mate. We're doing that. We're tag teaming all over the country, making sure we hit as many places as we can before November 5th, before Guy Fawkes Day, and before the day that if you choose to vote that way, you can free this country.
Excellent. Everyone, please go check out votechaseoliver.com. Contribute to Chase and Mike's campaign. These two guys, I've said it all year, this was the best slate of Libertarian candidates, in my opinion, that I've seen in a long time. So happy to have Chase and Mike representing Libertarian values on the ticket. And ladies and gentlemen, Donald Trump doesn't go to as many states to talk to as many people. Kamala Harris doesn't. Their VPs don't. Chase and Mike are actually men of the people. They're going to all 50 states. They visited all 50 states, continue to do so. Chase, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to everyone in the chats for your questions. Sorry we couldn't get to all of them. But until next time, Chase, good luck. And everyone right here on Grumblings Media, this has been Free for All with Big John. Check us out next time. Peace, everyone.